It's always an interesting flow of energy, both through the seasons and through the months and ultimately through the incarnations. Because in a very real sense, we're always existing in the same reality, but there's this whirling, changing rhythm that goes on also around us. And a part of the challenge of individuality on the spiritual path is sort of figuring out how we relate to the whole. How, as one person, we relate to the family we're born into, the people that gather around us, those we have to work with, whatever that reality might be. As human beings on the earth, how do we relate to the planet? As beings conscious of time, the seasons, everything. You know, we're in this cycle of time where it's so much darker. By 5:30, it's dark, and you have this whole sense of, I have a sense of confusion. Dark always confuses me. I couldn't imagine living in a place like Alaska or in Scandinavia where you have these long periods of darkness. I think I would just be befuddled the entire time. When I'm beginning to think I can't thrive in this darkness anymore, of course, then it transitions. And to a surprising extent, once we just make that tiny tip over, then all of a sudden light starts increasing. And there's this sense of ease and this sense of shift about things. On one level, what's happening in the seasons is so incidental to the soul's long journey. On another level, we're just participating in it all the time. Swami Kriyananda made a chilling remark once that I have... I've never had the nerve to really think about it seriously. He just commented casually, quote, "People think they're going through big karmic experiences, but most of the time it's just something physical, meaning your hormones are off or your kidneys are not working or your spleen isn't filtering your blood properly. You have a physiological disbalance." And then you take that into some exaggerated emotional story. I've never had the chance to ask him to elaborate on that. And I like to think I'm working out karma. I like to think it's not just an insufficiency of thyroid hormone or something like that. I mean, because the implications of that are, when do we actually work out karma if these experiences are not really that? But what he's really talking about is how interrelated so much of this world is. And it puts us in a paradox that is not so easy to resolve, because the name of our path is self-realization with a capital S, meaning the divine, not the little egoic self. I was distracted because Ananda had its less than 15 seconds of fame, because I think we got into somebody's blog as outrageous self-centered opportunities in Silicon Valley. We were one of 10 or 12 because there's a whole church dedicated to the self. This is what some newcomer to our valley pointed out. Well, I mean, he drove by. He put a picture of it there, Ananda Church of Self-Realization. I hope at least one of you is here because of that blog. That would just be so... That would be so fabulous, because the oddest things draw us to the path. And everybody has their moment of something. A book that I finished last year, which is called Loved and Protected, Stories of Miracles and Answered Prayers. And it's taken a year to get it into print. I understand it's now available, and I hope we'll have it by next week. But in one of the... I interviewed a lot of people. Swamiji started that book. He had this idea that we would write a book of miracles, and he started collecting the stories and pretty soon realized it wasn't his project, so he gave it over to me. I didn't feel that in tune with it when he gave it to me, but he knows better. He knows me better than I know myself. And the process of collecting the stories and talking to people about their divine experiences was a miracle and an answered prayer for me. And the book came out pretty well too, but that's something else. But one of the stories that I talked to this man who lives at Ananda now, he came to Ananda when he was younger. he had a whole boatload of karma that he needed to go through, and that karma just sucked him out. You know, like a turkey baster, you put it in and just sucks you out. Well, his karma just came and sucked him right out of the ashram, and he gallivanted around, and then when he was done doing that, he came back. And he was talking about how he first encountered Yogananda, and he was standing on a street corner, I think in a fairly unsavory area, in a fairly unsavory state of mind himself. And there was a bookstore that was closed because this was an early hour of the morning. And the blinds were almost completely closed. But it turns out there was a big poster of Yogananda's face there. And the blinds were closed except for the eyes. And he's standing on the street corner, I think under the influence of something that was not helpful. And he was standing there, and he looked across the street, and there are these huge pair of eyes just looking out this window at him. And there was enough of a vibratory connection that he came back when the store was open to find out what was there. Now, how many forces have to conspire for all of those things to be happening? Even for him to both be confused enough to be completely, he just didn't know what it was, who it was behind the window there. And at the same time to be standing there, for the clerk to be careless enough not to close the windows completely. I mean, just every single piece of that. So on one hand, we're always just moving through this completely interrelated universe. And on the other hand, the only real responsibility we have is for our own consciousness. And when finding the right balance between cooperation, receptivity, independence, creativity, all of these things are the very fine art of living as a human being in this world. And we've been very fortunate in our lives to not only have Yogananda's example, but to have the extremely interesting and long and easily accessible example of Swami Kriyananda for us. I commented once that, you know, there's many differences between our expression of Yogananda's work and Self-Realization, which is the other Yogananda organization, also founded and guided by direct disciples. But one of the differences is that Swami Kriyananda has always been completely accessible to us. There's been no facade between the leaders and the people. Of course, in his later years, and some of you have come at that time, when his physical body became more delicate, there had to be a bigger layer of protection. But nonetheless, hundreds of people have had meaningful and deep direct contact with him. And Swamiji was such an extraordinarily interesting blend of absolute independence and complete involvement. His willingness to relate to everyone on their own level, not just the people who came to the ashram, but everyone everywhere, combined with this enormous intellectual curiosity and involvement in so many things. It was a joke how he loved gadgets. He was, I think the phrase, an early adopter, is that what they call it in marketing? Adapter? I can never remember which the right word is. The person who always goes first. Swamiji, no matter how, from our point of view, wacky the item was, you know, there he was with the glasses that you put on that supposedly change your consciousness with the little flickering lights and the little thing that you kind of go all over your body and it zaps you like this. I mean, when you clean out his closet, there's just piles of these things. He was just always interested. And anybody who had an innovative idea that, you know, looked like it really might work, we met this woman who was into sound healing, and she could see the auric vibration of the Om, and she could see what notes were different, and she made this machine, and you would sit with the machine, and it would make these tones, and then your aura would go. I mean, we spent months and months, the whole community, and thousands of dollars working with these machines, trying to see how it would work, and he was just always completely capable of extending himself very far into whatever reality was around him without ever losing his center. You know, in the midst of all of that, he could be so supportive, but he would never lose his own place. And, you know, as many of you know, he was separated from Self-Realization Fellowship. Expelled is actually the word. Separated is the gracious word, but kicked out is the actual word. You know, because of their inability to work with his creativity. Now, I had a purpose in bringing that up, but I can't remember now what it was. Let me think what I might have wanted to say. Oh, I know what it was. But he himself sometimes, on occasion, expressed sympathy for the fact that they kicked him out because of him saying simply, if he felt he was right, he would just never change. And on occasion, when I myself had a point of view that was eccentric from other people's point of view, which occasionally happened to me just once in a while, and I would become a little emotionally involved in my point of view. And I remember once saying to Swamiji, well, I just didn't say anything because I didn't want to speak under the influence of emotion. He said, if you think you're right, don't ever give up. I mean, which is sort of an odd thing to say for the leader of a spiritual community where cooperation and harmony is so important. If you think you're right, don't ever give up. And walking that fine line, that's the reality we're looking for. Now, in our reading today, which is such a glorious reading to close the year with, I am the way, the truth, and the light. No one comes unto the Father except through me. What a contradiction of realities Jesus himself presented. I've been reading a book, The Visions of Therese Nuiman. Therese Nuiman is an autobiography of a yogi. She is the woman who would go for many years of her life. Every Friday she would live through the whole crucifixion of Christ, and she had the marks of the stigmata, and she would bleed, and I mean, it is, the only word that comes to mind is gruesome in the extreme. In Autobiography of a Yogi, when Master talks about going to see her in Bavaria where she lived, and he took his American secretary with him, Dick Wright, and they go in, they had special permission to go in and witness her vision. And she's there and she's experiencing the agonies of Christ and she's bleeding from all of his wounds. And Yogananda writes somewhat lightheartedly, I heard a thunk and I turned and I realized that Dick had fainted. He'd fallen to the floor just seeing her go through this experience. Well, I was just reading about her visions and just in great detail, everything that she sees. And man, that is one horrible story. On the level of just watching it, the Easter story, just watching it on the surface of it, the way that a human being is taken and tortured and, you know, the details of crucifixion are not pretty. I know they've put that into movies lately, and it's, on one hand, it's so completely bewildering. And on the other hand, that entire story rolls out into Jesus's complete transformation through that extraordinary difficulty. I mean, the story just couldn't be worse, really. And then you have Therese just living through it. She had that vision over 700 times that she lived through that. Swamiji said that Master said she herself was Mary Magdalene in a previous life. And that she just loved Jesus so much, she just wanted to share in this experience with him. I can't expand my consciousness enough to really understand that. I'm just repeating it because there it is. But on one hand, Jesus is speaking of himself, of his life, of how he lived. Now, the expansion we have to make is that Jesus is the only Savior and the only one who ever had this transcending ability and the only one who ever knew God. And unless you take him as your only Savior and all of those things that we're all very familiar with. So we can expand beyond that, but we can't disregard the way he lived and what that means for us, not just to follow in his literal footsteps, but to deal with life in the way that he dealt with it. When he saw what he had to do, in order to do the work that God had given him to do. He knew as a master where his life was leading him. And he knew just even as a practical man where his actions were leading him. He knew that the people he was constantly confronting, constantly antagonizing, constantly challenging, were becoming more and more enraged with him, and he knew they had the power to arrest him and put him to death. He saw exactly where his truth was leading him. But he knew he was right. And I don't just mean he was right in the sense that he was infinitely conscious and was acting out a part that had been given him to play, but he knew he was right. He knew they were hypocrites. He knew that they were using the spiritual truth for their own power. He knew that sincere people were being misguided and that it was time for a new reality to come forth. And he knew he was right, and he was never going to give up. And his rightness was not, I'm going to change the political system, which is what his disciples thought he was going to do. They thought he was going to be the Messiah that was going to rescue the Jewish people from this political oppression. And it was extremely tumultuous. And we have a very simple example of how these things work. When we think of autobiography of a yogi, Yogananda came to America in 1920. He died in 1952. Autobiography of a Yogi was published in 1946. So it was just the last few years of his life that sort of that story of who he was. And even that book is a very light touch about Yogananda. You sort of feel like it makes people want to go to India and find a master rather than go to Los Angeles and meet Yogananda when he was living there. And many people who read that book remember Babaji more than they remember Yogananda, because Babaji is so dramatic as the ever-living Himalayan yogi, and Yogananda is just the little Chota Mahashaya, just the little one going around meeting people. But let me just see now. Today is a day to keep losing my thought. Let me find out where I am. Oh, yes. So many people didn't have any idea who Yogananda was, or any idea how to relate to him. Many, many of his disciples left him. Many of his disciples betrayed him. He was more than one time sued and called into court. He was vilified in the press. He was thought to be an interesting but not particularly notable figure of the time. I mean, there was just, that was the way it was. It's not like that many people have ears to hear in the moment. It's the master puts the vibration out and it gains power over time. It's like a subtle force that, and also a great avatar like that is always ahead of his time. By very definition, he would have to be. He's coming to shift a direction for our whole society. And if the society were ready to shift, the avatar wouldn't be needed. I think about that in the work that Swami Kriyananda has done, in the work that Ananda itself is doing. Swami Kriyananda has created an entire way of life and has written in all his books, he's covered virtually every area of human endeavor, and he did that because that's what Master did. And then he expanded out from Master's work. And I often comment, and eventually people will care. And when they care, they will be just stunned by what this man has created. But now, you know, a handful of people care. Well, when Jesus lived and died, nobody really cared. There were lots of different prophets coming and going at the time. You know, he was just one of many. He was just this obscure rabbi that apparently, so they said, but who knows for sure, you know, did these various things. And then he was killed. But the power that's planted there, and coming back to this, the example of how he lived. Now, too much is made in traditional interpretation of his teachings of the crucifixion. And too little is made of the resurrection. I remember being in Vienna. We went to the church where the Vienna Boys Choir sings. That poor priest, I felt so sorry for that priest. Because you can buy an expensive ticket and go hear the Vienna Boys Choir sing, or you can come to Mass and hear the choir sing. So, of course, everybody comes to Mass. But they're not coming to Mass. They're coming to hear the choir sing. And this poor priest is trying to run a church and actually, you know, do the things he's supposed to do. And nobody's paying any attention to him. They're just listening to the singers. I felt almost badly being there. I tried really hard to be real attentive, you know, and really participate. But it was a real uphill struggle for the poor guy. But the one thing that they had in that church, and it was really the first time I'd ever seen one like this, they had Jesus on the cross. But instead of having Jesus on the cross as they usually have him, where he's all slumped over, you know, the really, really slumped over, defeated image, they had him on the cross, but he was standing on the cross in the posture of the resurrection. And I looked at that and I thought, now that's got it. That's got both. Because you remember that the power of his overcoming was not small. Because it doesn't work to just say, oh yeah, just be happy all the time. No matter what comes, just be happy. You know, really terrible things happen. And if our strength is either foolish or trivial, in order for us to endure with a positive attitude, we have to contract and contract our consciousness. And sometimes you meet people like that who are positive, but I don't want to draw too fine a point on it, but sometimes you can hear it in the voice. You can hear that the voice has been reduced to just a few notes. And there's just there's not a fullness of the heart. So we're able still to be positive, and everything is still really just fine. But we've had to do that by reducing our perception of reality instead of expanding so that whatever happens is just a wave on the ocean of the infinite. Because it wasn't as if Jesus wasn't crucified. It wasn't as if his own people turned against him. And he wept for his own people because there he had this message. And I'm not talking about Jews and Christians and all of that. I'm just talking about the people he came to help. And he came to help them and they didn't want him. And when he knew what he had to offer, imagine what that was. That was his agony. His agony was, yes, physical, but for a man of his stature, of his spiritual understanding, of which the body he inhabited was like the clothes that we wear. You know, the actual suffering, not because it wasn't as bad as it looked, but because in the context of his consciousness, Swamiji had artificial hips, and he said he had three hips replaced because for some reason they had to do one of the hips twice, and I don't remember why now. Swamiji did not like to take full anesthesia. He did not like to be forced into unconsciousness, and he managed to persuade the surgeons that they could replace his hips with a local anesthesia, with a spinal block. But the second or third operation, they gave him an insufficient amount of whatever they needed to give him. And he came back into the awareness of his lower body while they were still sewing him up. And he said he knew at that point the only choice would have been they couldn't have given him another spinal. They would have had to give him full anesthesia. And he didn't want to take that. So he just didn't. And he made no indication that he was feeling them sewing him up. I mean, just the thought of it just makes you shudder, right? And what I often contemplate that, and I realize not only did he have the presence of mind to sort all that out, but he also was able to control his body to such an extent that the surgeon had no idea. And it wasn't until afterwards when the anesthetologist came to visit him in the room and asked if he could, quote, wiggle his toes. And Swami indicated that his whole body was functioning. And the anesthetologist realized, that is anesthesiologist. Anesthetologist is the one who does your face, right? The anesthesiologist realized that it had worn off during the operation. Right. Now, when you have that kind of consciousness, and when I asked Swami, how do you manage that? He said, first, I try to concentrate on something else. I write music, he said, or I work on a writing project. And he says, if that doesn't work, I concentrate on the pain and try to see if I can penetrate past it. And if that doesn't work, I say, well, it's been a good life. A few minutes of suffering won't be so tough. Right? Just, it depends in the proportion. So Jesus is there and he knows. I mean, he knows everything is an omnipresent reality. He knows. He knows what it's all about. He knows what this is for. And even in the moment of acceptance, inherent in that is the resurrection. I am the way, the truth, and the life. And no one comes to the Father except through me. What is the Father? The Father is Satchitananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. And no one does come there except by the way he walked. He was there for God's purpose. He knew what that purpose was. He allowed nothing to deflect him from that purpose, and he accepted every implication of that dedication without flinching, knowing that it's a moment in time. Some moments might be more pleasant than others, but it's all just a moment in time, waves on the ocean. I'd like to be giving you a more cheerful end of the year message, and I didn't really intend to be quite so grim. You know, but it really, it's the greatest good news, really, that there is. And that's what the life of Christ was about. Because the suffering is inherent. We all know it. His was conspicuously more dramatic than others. But each of us is pushed to the limit. Isn't it so? No matter how tiny our limit may be, we all feel at different times that we can hardly handle what's happening, And those are the moments. Those are the moments when you understand that the very crucifixion is also the resurrection. And how you step into it, how you live in this moment, determines the next one. And there's no alternative. Very early in my spiritual life, even before I met Swamiji, when I really came onto the path, I spent what I considered to be, I remember it as being awake all night. Sometimes the mind deceives you, but that's what I remember. Because I kept looking for an alternative. Is there any choice except getting my own, well, I'll use the phrase, head together, you know? Is there any choice here except always being trapped inside my own perception of reality? And is there anything that could ever change that fact? I could distract myself from it. I could try to kill it by suicide, which I somehow knew wasn't going to work. I could go loony, you know, and just check out and go into a subconscious imaginary world. But sooner or later, I would still be there. And so, okay, let's deal with the main event, which is my own consciousness. And how do I move from this confinement into the freedom of Satchitananda? Well, Jesus said it. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the light. No one comes to that freedom except in the footprints that I have laid before you. I is the Satchitananda. I have achieved it. I am that which you seek. And through the life that I have lived, your life then will shine like his. God bless you.